Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
Everyone loves a good label diss story.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you try to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sitaro. This is episode 171, a talk with Monica Lynch. Monica started out in late 1981 as the very first employee of a small record label called Tommy Boy, which was releasing early rap and electro singles by the likes of Afrika Bambaataa and the Johnson Crew. She quickly worked her way up to becoming the label's president, and oversaw its most fertile period during hip-hop's golden age of the late 1980s and early 90s. Under Monica's tenure, the label released classic albums by Queen Latifah, De La Soul, Naughty by Nature, Stetsasonic, Paris, Digital Underground, CNN, House of Pain, and many more. Monica was a key part of bringing Tommy Boy to the attention of the masses. She oversaw the label's clothing line, its successful compilation albums, and also played an important part in the development of careers of artists, executives, and more, ranging from the RZA to Dante Ross to Prince Paul. We talked to Monica Lynch at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. As we sat down to begin our conversation, she pulled some cassettes out and showed them to us. You won't believe what was on them. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cipher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you do that, make sure to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another rap industry veteran, Def Jam's Bill Adler, on episode 43. Also, consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every single week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed a dollar a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. For November, you can hear material from the tapes Monica brought us that no one's ever heard before. Become a patron by October 31st, to have access to the file. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's Naughty by Nature's favorite snake handler, Monica Lynch.
I just brought a couple of demo tapes.
Oh, wow.
But
you can definitely get pictures and stuff.
You can get pictures and stuff. It's
What do you have?
Well, it's late Prince Rakim, early Wu-Tang.
Nice. Wow. Can I see them?
Yes.
Wow. So, yeah, so this is Prince Rakim demo from November 6th, 1991. Two versions of I Get Down From My Crown.
Like most people in 2016, we no longer have an audio cassette player in the studio. After frantically searching for someone who could record these tapes out during the interview, finally, we ran to the drugstore and found a dust-covered Craig portable that probably hadn't moved since 1992. So that's why we've got these clips. Better portable Craig sound than not at all. If you'd like to hear more of any of the songs we're about to play from these tapes, become a Patreon supporter before the end of October 2016.
Did he end up putting that out?
I don't know.
With
I don't
you?
Think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
I Get Down From My Crown was never released by the RZA, then known as Prince Rakim. The EP released on Tommy Boy by Prince Rakim, Ooh, We Love You, Rakim, contained the three tracks, Ooh, We Love You, Rakim, Deadly Venoms, and Sexcapades. You can find some copies of the first version of I Get Down From My Crown on the internet, but we haven't found this second version anywhere but on the tape Monica brought us.
I'll be honest with you. I haven't listened to those since, you know, date of issue. But those were demo tapes that A&R man Kevin Maxwell gave to myself and other people at Tommy Boy who were...
Yeah, and you can tell it's an actual demo. There's even, you know, something covering under, you know, a printed out cover covering the handwritten stuff on the
yeah
Rakim demo, which is amazing. And then a Wu-Tang demo from March 92. So this has Illusion of Love remix.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't even... And then the original mix. When I was young, it was hard to be a man. So many things I didn't understand. Like... Instrumental of Enter the Wu-Tang. All the way! And then Pass the Bone featuring the Genius. Pass the bone! Pass the bone so I can call it like a wall. Side of that club, we shine some young blood. Drink the 40s right down to the studs. These are incredible. So you listened to them at the time?
At the time, yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, I guess we might as well start there. So you obviously were dealing with RZA back when he was Prince Rakim. Oh, we love you,
Rakim. From Staten Island.
Yeah, how'd you come across him in the first place? Do you remember?
Gosh, you know, I don't quite recall how we came across Prince Rakim, but it was one of those... he was from Staten Island, and his manager at the time was a guy named the Funky Mel Kwan.
Mm, yeah, Mel Kwan and Shabazz shouted out on pretty much every rap record in New York of a certain era. Can't forget Supreme, Abu, Mel Kwan and Shabazz, Wally D, and the rest of the brothers. Your house stayed for an hour, then he left.
Shabazz went, then Mel Kwan went next, hour by hour, minute by... Yeah, and so as everybody knows, Prince Rakim... his origins were with a definitely sort of a, you know, silly type of a rap record. I'm sure he's probably still embarrassed about to this day, but it was I Love You, Rakim.
Right. Oh, we love you,
Rakim. And then, and it didn't really hit or anything, but he was a great guy. And it was interesting because we knew it was, you know, it was apparent early on that it wasn't going to click and was like sort of, you know, just not going to be taken seriously. But he went away. He would make these sort of, you know, disappearances. And I say, Mel Kwan, where's, you know, Rakim? He goes, oh, you know, he's in Cleveland for a while or he's here. And but, you know, I'm still, you know, Mel Kwan worked at this, one of those fur wholesalers in the West 30s. He says, but hey, come on by and, you know, I'll hook you up with a coat and stuff like that. So I really think my theory is that Rakim was going through the metamorphosis into RZA.
Right.
And when he fully emerged as RZA, it was, you know, with the Wu-Tang Clan. And but I think that these demos probably represent that transitional period between, you know, it's not like he woke up overnight and like, hey, now I'm RZA, you know.
Yeah, from what he said, he definitely acknowledges that you and folks at the label at that time saw his talent back then. I mean, obviously you signed him, so you must have.
Yeah. I think he's an amazing story, a great story about how he went on to completely change. You know, a lot of rappers don't get that second chance, and he made this huge... I mean, I can walk around in my neighborhood in Sunnyside and see, like, you know, these 30-year-old guys wearing Wu-Tang Clan t-shirts, so, you know, in 2016. But, yeah, no, he's done it all.
Yeah.
And a smart guy, really smart guy. He really understood, you know, grasping and making other opportunities for himself. Yeah, I always liked him.
Amazing.
And I hope Mel Kwan is out there. Yo, Funky Mel Kwan, he's still on West 38th.
So the very, I actually saw, you posted on Twitter, the ad you answered to get the job at Tommy Boy.
Yeah.
Which was, all it said was office manager.
at that point.
It's a guy gal Friday,
yeah,
is what it said when they still use that sort of parlance in ads. Yeah, I was, you know, one of those kids that came to New York with a dollar and a dream, 1978, you know, corn fed girl from the Midwest, Chicago. And, but I'd already been, you know, hanging out and doing the nightlife scene there pretty heavy. And I came here and, you know, I always tell people I went straight from LaGuardia to Studio 54, which is an exaggeration, but not by much.
Right.
So I always started hanging out at between the Mud Club and Studio 54 and living in the Chelsea Hotel and doing all of the, you know, late 70s, early 80s downtown, you know, wannabe moves. And, but I always, I shouldn't say always, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was working as a topless dancer to make money on 42nd Street. So that was my career, as such as it was.
What was 42nd Street like in those days? Because people sort of very much look back of like, oh, it was, you know, seedy and it's not like that anymore and, you know, whatever.
Yeah, well, it was seedy, but, you know, a lot of New York was seedy back then. You know, had been living on St. Mark's Street in the spring and summer of 1978. And this woman who lived across the street, who I'd met before, her name was Anya Phillips. Anya was one of the creators of the Mud Club, and she was the girlfriend slash manager for James Chance. And she was a very take charge, you will do what I say type of gal. And she marched across the street one day and said, you're going to be a go-go dancer and I'm going to sell you G-strings. And there was this, she really took charge of people like me that didn't know what the hell they were doing. She was a really, really fantastic character in that whole world. Yeah, there was an ad in the Village Voice for a place called the Go-Go Agency, which was, yes, Go-Go Agency. Yeah. And I'm sure it was, this is an ad that was probably in there every week, but I went and into Midtown, climbed the long flight of stairs. It was like being in some Woody Allen movie, yeah. And, you know, met Johnny, the booker from the Go-Go Agency, you know, big, you know, blackboard up on the wall with what girls were working at what places. And so basically he was booking me as a topless dancer, as I like to say, in all five boroughs. And, so, you know, I'd go work at places like The Slice in the Bronx, you know, or, you know, the Ladies downtown on Church Street. You know, there's all these different places, a lot in Midtown. And so eventually I got extended residencies at a couple of 42nd Street places. One was called Peepland, the infamous Peepland. Mm-hmm. And the other one, which a lot of your listeners will know about, is Show World.
Mm.
So, yeah.
I've heard about that place.
Show World, with its famous marquee, was at one point a facility complete with strippers, peep shows, video booths, and a wide selection of adult movies, magazines, toys, and novelties. It stopped showing live girls in 1998 and shut down completely in 2004.
Yeah, so this is 78, 79, 80 in there. So it was, yeah, you're sort of at that peak Times Square era before the big crackdown that came in the 80s when they started cleaning the place up. There's a great show. I haven't seen it yet, but David Simon and George Pelicanos have created a show that's going to be on HBO called The Deuce.
Oh.
That is set in the Times Square sex industry scene in the 70s and early 80s. So I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Wow. So nightlife-wise, though, there were kind of two strands that people now think of as separate, although maybe they really weren't, and you can fill me in on that. You kind of had the punk and disco scenes back then kind of preeminent.
I think that there was overlap between those scenes, You know, certainly if you were looking at an artist that embodied that, you might say Blondie, you know. But if you went down to the Mud Club, you know, you heard a lot of funk, R&B, you know, your no wave and punk and all that stuff. But it was definitely, you know, a disco dance nightclub. And there were a lot of people who went there who would also go to Studio 54, you know, and listen to, you know, Donna Summer or Diana Ross or whatever. They were both they both had their own style of glamour and glitz. And I loved both of those scenes.
Yeah. And you were involved in a punk disco even back in Chicago.
Yes. Yes, that is true. It was a really critical club called La Mer Vapeur, which was owned by a great guy who's no longer with us named Noah Boudreau. And it was called the Snake Pit over on Halsted and Armitage. And it was a gay bar, a gay disco slash bar. It wasn't a big place. But he was having some difficulty getting steady business. And one of the guys who worked there, Mike Rivers, a.k.a. Sparkle, who also worked at a big record store in Chicago, suggested that he switch over to this newfangled punk stuff that the kids were starting to listen to. And so they tried it out on a Sunday night, and I was one of the first, you know, part of that initial group of people that converged on this place, and I ended up being a bartender there and was like lead hairdo in a band. Well, I was never a singer, much of a singer. But yeah, I was part of that whole La Mer Vapeur crowd. And La Mer Vapeur actually was hugely part of the inspiration for the Mud Club, because in 1977, not long after La Mer Vapeur started, Steve Maz, Anya Phillips, and Diego Cortez, who has roots in Chicago, and we have a mutual roommate in common, drove to Chicago in an ambulance, because I guess Steve Maz's family had an ambulance business, and they were either going to Memphis or coming from Memphis to shoot. Diego was shooting a film called My Private Elvis. But anyway, they drove through Chicago in this ambulance, and they came to La Mer Vapeur, which was just on fire. And then they went back to New York and opened the Mud Club, and it very much had, you know, similar DNA. Yeah. It was basically sort of like a punk disco.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Wow. And, you know, so around, I think, 82, like you said, you started at Tommy Boy.
Late 81. Okay. It was like December of 1981.
Wow.
And, so I saw that. I actually transitioned from topless dancing to being a waitress. Mm. I said, let me make an honest living here. The dancing didn't seem, you know, I was like, oh, I don't like the people I work for, the people I work with, the customers. It's all getting a little creepy. So I went over to waitressing. And while I was doing that, I went to the first, what I think was the first new music seminar.
I was going to ask. Okay. I didn't realize you went there even before you worked for Tom.
Yeah.
Tom Silverman, the founder and CEO of Tommy Boy Records, started the new music seminar in 1980 along with Mark Josephson, Danny Heaps, and Scott Anderson. The influential music conference and festival ran uninterrupted until 1995 and had a second run from 2009 to 2015.
Yeah, well, I met Tom at that new music seminar very briefly. It was held at a recording studio called Intergalactic, I think was the name of it. It was in the East 80s, and a guy named Bob Pittman was there talking about this new thing that he was launching called MTV, you know, and so there's a lot was going on in the air. But I met Tom very briefly there. And then I guess it was later that year, or maybe it was the following year, I saw the ad for Guy Gal Friday for a small industry, you know, trade publication slash record label, and followed that ad up not knowing that it was Tom. And I don't even know if he remembered meeting me at that new music seminar, but had some interviews via phone, then an in-person interview. And, you know, he was pretty tough on me. He said, well, what makes you think you're qualified to, to do this? I mean, I didn't go to college. I don't, you know, not particularly well schooled or anything. Not that that is necessarily the criteria for being a, you know, making it in the music business. But what I think sealed the deal was when I met with him in person, he said, well, I'm heading out to the pressing plant in Long Island City, which was Apexton, owned by these two Polish brothers who were had a pressing plant that serviced some of the independent labels around town. And you know, he had a hatchback car, and I started slinging the 50-count vinyl boxes into the back of the car. He said, oh, okay, we can get some work out of her. Now, you had to have that sort of, you know, not be afraid to do any, you know.
And it was literally just the two of you when you started.
Yeah, well, and Tom also, yes, on the Tommy Boy side, but he also had Dance Music Report, which was coming out every other week.
Dance Music Report, originally called Disco News, was started by Tom Silverman and two of his college friends in 1978. It was a biweekly U.S. trade magazine oriented toward nightclub and radio DJs in the dance music industry.
So I was working for both entities, and it was he had an office in the second bedroom of his apartment up in Yorkville. And so the woman who was the editor of Dance Music Report was in there. I was in there. Tom, you know, the guy who was doing typesetting and laying out the Dance Music Report. I mean, it was, you know, it was both things. You know, got to get the Dance Music Report to the printer at the same time. You know, Sunshine Record Distributors wants to order the new record, you know, and it was a lot going on. Yeah. All at once. It was great. It was a real baptism of fire.
I can imagine, especially because, you know, you had hit records pretty quickly. I think Jazzy Sensation was before you joined, or was that released?
It was being, it was just being released. And it was sort of the first hit. It was, you know, not an you know, huge hit, but it was a hit.
Yeah.
We got quality and sophistication, and all we need is your cooperation.
And I remember Tom and his girlfriend at the time, who were living together, went to Jamaica on a vacation. He said, and this is right after I started. He says, okay, so you're going to be in charge while I'm gone. So that meant taking orders, putting in the pressers with, you know, sound makers or Apex. And I think we were still with Apex at the time. You know, working on Dance Music Report, doing all this stuff. And I remember taking an order from an account that I wasn't supposed to take an order from, because sometimes with these one stops and distributors, you had to be careful because, you know, you get ripped off. So, sure. But anyway, that was, I think, the one mistake that I made. But I remember in the course of this two-week period, it was approximately, one of the people who showed up at the door at Tom's apartment, it was a friend of his, and who gave me a very calming, like, you can do this, you know, pat on the back, was Corey Robbins.
Oh, okay.
From Profile.
Corey Robbins founded Profile Records in 1981. The influential label would release key early rap hits from Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and the Disco Four before signing Run DMC in 1983. That group's success enabled the label to get acts like Dana Dane, Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock, Special Ed, Poor Righteous Teachers, DJ Quick, King's Son, and more.
Who I'm still friends with to this day, so that's how I met Corey. But yeah, it was great. It was... You know, that first wave of like, oh, my God, yeah. You know, it's all happening at once.
And interestingly, you know, because I guess because Tom was coming from a dance music background.
Yes.
And the idea of a rap album wasn't a thing. You know, in the early 80s, you guys had single deals and didn't sign people to the rights for albums, at least initially, right?
Well, not only was it just singles, these were generic 12-inch singles. There wasn't artwork for them, you know. It was just, it was a 12-inch market, but that's, you know, pretty much how it was in other genres as well, unless it was some big established hit artist or it was an import or something where people spent money on artwork. But yeah, it was, I don't know if the early contracts had options for albums, but if they didn't, I'm sure they did pretty soon thereafter. So right.
The one time I met Tom, he expressed some regret about waiting so long because negotiations were complicated to get an album out after Planet Rock hit, that it was just like, it sort of took too long and momentum was lost by the time a full album came out after the song.
Yeah, I don't quite recall that the momentum was lost because I think the album still did well, but yeah, it probably should have been out sooner.
Planet Rock came out as a single in 1982, while Planet Rock, the album, didn't come out until 1986.
I mean, in an ideal world, you've got an album recorded
right
before you drop the first single. But this really, you know, the waters were still being tested with all of this. I mean, I don't know if there were any rap albums besides perhaps Sugar Hill Gang.
Right. They didn't even really become a thing till like 85, 86, really.
Yeah. You know, the first group that really comes to my mind as having big hit albums in the early days was Houdini.
Houdini's self-titled album was released in 1983 and was the first rap album to break into the top 40 and eventually went platinum. Their follow-up LP, Escape, released the following year, was equally successful.
They really had national success, and I think that their sound was had a radio friendliness to it that helped. But yeah, they had a couple, at least a couple of platinum albums. And it's funny because, you know, Barry Weiss and Ann Carley were at Jive, were just a couple blocks away from us in Yorkville. No one thinks of like Yorkville is like, you know,
industry,
it's like the hip hop hinterlands, but Tommy Boy and Jive were both up there in the early 80s.
Amazing. So how did Planet Rock change things for you?
Very fundamentally. It was early 1982, and the track had been recorded, and I remember that very clearly that we had plates for Planet Rock, and Tom and I, we went in his car and drove over to WHBI up on Riverside Drive, not far from the Cypher headquarters.
Yeah, here,
and delivered Planet Rock to Magic, who was on the air with Marley. And he played it, and, you know, it was like, bam, you know, huge. It was, that record hit so fast and so hard, and it was an amazing thing to witness because literally, you know, this is the warm weather is just starting to come in, and, you know, people were riding around in their cars, windows open. It was on, like, every boombox, every car radio, every club. I mean, it really crossed a lot of party lines, you know, because you would hear it. And it wasn't, you know, just a rap record. You know, it was a record that, you know, went far and wide and really the whole country. And then, you know, Europe and Japan, everyone, you know, Planet Rock really was an enormous, enormous hit. And it was, as a label, and I'm sure Tom has discussed this with you too, but it was, man, you know, fast and furious. I think the 12-inch did about 650,000. and put that in perspective with a Jazzy Sensation, which I think might have done maybe, I'm guessing here, 40 or so, you know. So this was like, we couldn't keep up with, you know, the production and the sales and everything. It was a total game changer.
That's amazing. And, you know, one other sort of early Tommy Boy record that was a little unusual that I wanted to ask you about was No Sellout. Was it
the
Keith LeBlanc record that was just, you know, Malcolm X samples over a beat, essentially.
There'll be no skullduggery, no flim-flam. No compromise, no sellout. No control show.
Really, one of the first records to use sampling as like a central thing. What do you remember about making that, you know, putting out that record?
Well, geez, I remember, you know, that we had to have rights in place with Betty Shabazz. I remember Keith LeBlanc, you know, being the creative force behind it. And I remember some difficulties with Sugar Hill related to No Sellout, and I can't quite recall what it was.
Keith LeBlanc was actually an in-house drummer at Sugar Hill Records and approached them originally with the idea for No Sellout. He actually recorded it at the label studio, but took the song to Tommy Boy when he realized that Sugar Hill had no intention of paying Malcolm's widow Betty Shabazz for the use of her husband's voice. Sugar Hill unsuccessfully sued Tommy Boy over No Sellout, claiming that Tommy Boy profited from voice samples that belonged to them.
Tommy actually would know this more than I would, but it was an influential record. It was not a hit record.
Right.
You know, not in the commercial sense. It's the type of record that we look back at now and say, oh, man, No Sellout, that was like a really cool, different, you know, it was a, you know, important record. It's an important record. But I can't begin to tell you how uninterested Black Radio was in playing a Malcolm X record. I mean, it's the truth, right. You know, sad to say, but true.
Well, that's one of the things that, you know, was tough and that people kind of forget looking back is that radio and even video to an extent was not open to hip hop until, you know, years after you guys started as a label.
Yeah, really there were specialty shows like Mr. Magic before he was on WBLS, Red, you know, before Red was on Kiss. But, you know, like the Awesome Two and, you know, college radio shows. But it was really early days, and it was before the majority of commercial Black radio even had designated rap shows. And, I mean, I've said this before, but, you know, rap was still considered sort of a disgrace to the race in many bougie, you know, Black radio and you know, Black music departments at major labels. It wasn't embraced. You know, Frankie Crocker and, you know, Barry Mayo, and also Carlos de Jesus at WKTU and Michael Ellis at WKTU, they were early to, you know, get it together and have, you know, rap shows on the major New York stations. But it's sort of, you know, a lot of it was college radio stations and club DJs.
And, you know, one of the bigger moves that you at Tommy Boy made in your early years into like a pop market was with the Force MDs on the
yeah.
Crush Groove soundtrack. Obviously, as we're talking, it's not that long after Trisco Pearson's passing.
Trisco, rest in peace.
Yeah.
Yes, that was an important record for Tommy Boy as a label, and for a couple reasons. The way it came about was that Crush Groove was being made. George Jackson and Doug McHenry were overseeing, you know, producing the film here in New York. And I actually was dating Doug at the time. And, you know, despite my best efforts and thinking that I was in the catbird seat to get my group on the label, get on the soundtrack, you know, he kept saying, no, you know, we got New Edition. New Edition's going to, you know, because New Edition was huge. Mm-hmm. And the Force MDs had some success, but they weren't as big as New Edition. So what happened was, is that for some sort of contractual reason, in the 11th hour, 59th minute, New Edition wasn't going to record this track with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. Mm-hmm.
Who at that point were just some unproven Prince proteges.
Well, you know, they had had success with the SOS band, but they had not blown up yet with Janet Jackson.
Right.
You know, they were on the cusp of major stardom, but they were still, you know, established as big producers. And so literally within a 24-hour period when New Edition dropped out, I get the call from Doug, can you get these guys on a plane to Minnesota, you know, yesterday? So it was, boy, we had to scramble real fast because just get the legalities all squared away, get the group on board and get up, you know. We had to move quickly. And like the album had to master and, you know, everything was behind schedule. So finally we got the guys up to Minnesota. And I remember Jimmy and Terry, you know, worked them so hard because they only had X number of hours to get this done. But the result was Tender Love. And that was Jimmy and Terry's first top 10 pop hit. It was certainly Tommy Boy's first top 10 pop hit. And it also, because the soundtrack album was on Warner Brothers, created a conduit for Tommy Boy and Warner Brothers at a time where doing business or having some sort of arrangement or deal, overall deal with Warner Brothers, helped Tommy Boy.
And that relationship with Warner Brothers would sort of develop a few years later.
Well, no, it developed directly as a result of that, mm-hmm. The mid-80s. I would say it must have been 85, mm-hmm. 85, 86. So, huge record for the Force MDs for Tommy Boy and Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. So, yeah, it's a big one.
Yeah. So you guys had your early hits as a label were kind of in this electro vein.
Yes.
We were talking about a little bit. And then, you know, later on come like, you know, 88, 89, you have, you know, another era. But there were kind of some awkward years in the middle there.
Yes. There were awkward years in the middle. Yeah. The first wave of success included the African Bambaataa and Soul Sonic Force record. Rock the House by Pressure Drop. Put your hands up in the air and wave them like you just don't care. I say diggy, 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 don't stop. Diggy, don't stop. I say diggy, 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 don't stop. The Johnson Crew. Which really, you know, people don't talk about the Johnson Crew as much these days, but they were huge. They had a big, massive success with, you know, in Texas and South and places where we didn't typically have airplay. Mm. Planet Patrol was huge. But, and yeah, there were some other, Globe and Whiz Kid was big. But yes, there was an emergence of a different sound. Really, you know, the Run DMC era had begun. It was a harder, tougher sound. The electro sound was on the, it was going out. And so, yeah, in the mid 80s, we didn't have a whole lot of big hits. The Force MDs, though, were definitely making inroads, and there was like having R&B/hip-hop records, and that was great. And Stetsasonic sort of came in the, geez, I'm going to say around 86, 87.
Yeah.
We start with Stetsasonic.
Right about this time, we'll make you shake and shiver. The devastating route we can deliver. And the sucker MC, to us, you're reminded. We dominate the chart because we are the world's finest king.
Stetsasonic's debut single, Just Say Stet, was released on Tommy Boy in 1985. And their first album, On Fire, came out the following year.
There wasn't anything that was quite as explosive as in terms of a big, you know, commercial hit. Great records. Everyone was doing important work. But the next wave really began in the late 80s.
Right. And one of the most important figures in that, and someone, you know, you still have a close relationship with, is Queen Latifah.
Yes.
So reading about it, it seemed like she kind of came at you from a couple different directions. And mm-hmm. what I mean by that is there was, you know, the 45 King sort of was telling you about her and a couple other people. Sort of, so how did she cross your path?
Yeah, there were queen whisperers.
Right.
Well, she wasn't even queen at that point.
Dana from New Jersey.
She was like, she was Latifah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she's just Latifah. But yeah, Dante Ross, a young A&R guy that I hired. It was his first A&R gig. Fab Five Freddy. And 45, Mark 45 King, we're sort of all sort of, yeah.
You can hear Dante Ross's and the 45 King stories of discovering Queen Latifah and a whole lot more on Cypher episodes 34 and 115, respectively.
And so all of them contributed to sort of creating awareness for her. Yeah, she came in, young girl, she's probably like 18 at the time, and she really had this otherworldly sort of presence and grace and intelligence. And here she's sitting there with, you know, sweatshirt and jeans, you know, coming from New Jersey, which at the time, coming from New Jersey wasn't such a cool place to be coming from. And, you know, but everyone in the office, like, oh, she had presence. That's what she had. She had great presence. And Dante did a fantastic job overseeing her recordings, and 45 King just, you know, probably doesn't get the credit he deserves for all the work he did on her first album. And yeah, so she was a big part of that big second wave that included De La Soul and Queen Latifah and Digital Underground and Naughty by Nature and House of Pain. And, you know, am I leaving anyone out?
Those are some pretty big ones.
Those are some pretty big ones. Stetsasonic, of course, continuing into that era as
right.
well.
At what point did it kind of dawn on you that, hey, Latifah could be a even bigger celebrity kind of outside of rapping?
You know, the thing was, is that Latifah, when I think from her first single to her next single, she went from Latifah to Queen Latifah. And there was some very iconic photographs that were taken of her. And she, you know, wearing her crown and her African garb. And she was on, you know, Yo MTV Raps.
Latifah is big and ready. I'm cooling out with DJ Mark and Fab Five Freddy. And also this show is called Yo MTV. So watch me boss it up for you right fast now.
Do it, Dada.
It's the law. The T-I-F-A-H. Voila. See my rhyme. Mark creates the direct
And the woman at Tommy Boy who was doing press and publicity for us, Laura Hines, did just an amazing job getting media attention for her. But, you know, it's also one of those things, and this has just always been a thing with me.
I think there's so much to be said for a name. You know, if when you hear the name Queen Latifah, it's like, what? Queen Latifah? I mean, the name itself is so intriguing and beautiful. I sort of feel the same way like De La Soul had that. Like, what is De La? You know, but Queen Latifah, you know, people, I think, just completely were getting it. She had this strong, powerful presence and, you know, this woman-centric, Afrocentric vibe going on around her. She just seemed, you know, large and in charge. She was an always amazing live performer. When she performed one of her very early shows at the Hotel Amazon downtown, all the power went out. Mics went off. And you know how it is. With a lot of rap acts, they're like, yo, fuck the sound, man. Yo, man, I'm getting the fuck out of here. Yo, yo. You know, they start melting down and freaking out because, you know, she just kept going and just had everyone in the palm of her hand. And she quickly became an intriguing figure for the media at large and for other people. They were like, who's this Queen Latifah? Da, 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 da. And they see these pictures or read about her. And so it wasn't long before I got a call from Spike Lee asking about, you know, he said, oh, I'm making this new movie. I think there might be a part in here for Queen Latifah. Can you put me in touch with, you know? So I didn't do it. It did nothing except, you know, put them in touch with each other. But, you know, if we did anything, I think we did a good job of presenting her to the world. Mm-hmm. But she and her partner, Shakim, her business partner, Shakim, did a great job of, you know, seizing the opportunities that came from that and continue to do incredibly well. So I know she's in the new Lee Daniels television series that's coming out.
Ever since Star was little, she believed her name was who she was. But I told her, fame is a trip. It ain't love like a lot of people think. But she wouldn't listen.
Cause just when I was about to give,
and you've had a role even on some of her more recent albums in terms of like helping with song selection and stuff like that.
Yeah. 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 No, I mean, Dana and Shakim and I've had a close relationship over all these years. And I was very honored to be asked to come in and A&R her two jazz albums from 2004 and 2007.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine. Oh, baby, 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 baby. I'm not in love. So don't forget it. It's just a silly face I'm going through.
Worked on the first one with great friend of mine, Joe McEwen, who's one of the best A&R guys out there. And then, you know, it just took her to a whole new level, you know, because the thing was Dana could always sing and she's kind of shy about it, but she could always sing. And when she was in Chicago, the movie Chicago, that sort of broke down a lot of walls, too. People said, oh, shit.
Got a little motto, always sees me through. When you're good to mama, mama's good to you.
You know, so it almost it led to, you know, her recording those albums. But you know, also I think about the early days of Tommy Boy, you know, she wasn't just doing rap records, you know, she had Come Into My House.
Come into my house. Don't make me wait. Don't come into my house. Give me body. Don't make me wait.
Which
also was a record that crossed a lot of party lines as well. She sang How Do I Love Thee?
I'm like a child within your arms. Would you come inside and play with me? Spend the day with me. Have your way with me. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways.
She did unusual things that really didn't fit any pre-existing mold.
Yeah. And, you know, Tommy Boy had one of my favorite middle school groups, Digital Underground, who I listened to constantly in seventh and eighth grade, the Sex Packets album.
One of my favorites.
What was Shock G like to work with at that point?
He was fantastic to work with. And I just want to also give a big shout out to Ed Strickland, who was doing radio promotion for us. And it was through Ed and his relationship with Atron Gregory that led us to signing Digital Underground. Atron is their manager. And but Shock was so much fun and so great and so, you know, really sensitive. I mean, this guy was an artist with a capital A. And we used to have, like, you know, phone conversations late at night. And he was just, you know, here's a guy who's this great cartoonist and caricaturist. And he did the artwork on the early singles. Well, he always oversaw the artwork. He had the whole vision for the stage show, the whole vision for Humpty.
So just let me introduce myself.
And the whole vision for everyone involved, including Tupac,
right?
You know, which is where Tupac got his start.
Because my name is Shock, I like to rock, and you can't stop this. Tupac, go ahead and rock this.
Now I clown around when I hang around with the underground. Girls used to frown, say I'm down when I come around. Gas me and when they pass.
Tupac began his rap career as a dancer for Digital Underground. And his first recorded vocal performance was on the group's 1991 single, Same Song.
And great musician. He really visualized everything about Digital Underground, you know, and he had a great team with him, too, you know, all the guys in the group. And, you know, there's only one regret that I have. The only regret that I have is that I don't have any more sex packets.
Sex packets, a dollar or two. Just tell me how many for you this time. This time.
Digital Underground's 1990 debut album, Sex Packets, was, in part, a concept album about a fictional ecstasy-like drug called Genetic Suppression Release Antidote, or GSRA, or, as it was known on the street, Sex Packets. According to Shock G, the drug was supposed to induce a dream state and allow someone to see who they wanted and have real-seeming sex with them in that dream state. The idea came from Shock's friend Smooth, who sings on the album's title track. He actually believed the drug could be real and thought he even might get government grant money to research it. Smooth believed, according to Shock, that it would be particularly helpful for astronauts. The group created a story that the drug had leaked onto the streets of San Francisco and even created and distributed thousands of pamphlets in the city warning people of its dangers.
Do they actually make them?
Yeah, we made them.
Item? Oh, wow.
We made sex packets. Where you been, Sean? That was one of the biggest things ever. When we did the Sex Packets album, put out Sex Packets, I said, why don't we make sex packets? You know, because it was this whole funny,
right, it was
whole imaginary.
Concept of the record. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a conceptual thing. But we actually got, they weren't Necco wafers, but they were something like Necco wafers. And we put them in these little tinfoil packets, like the sort of thing you know, like condom packaging. And we had, like, geez, I think three or four different ones, you know, with photos on each one. And we sent them out. And people, is this shit real? Oh, my God. You know, it was a great, funny kind of mind fuck. It was great. It was really a lot of fun.
Oh, my God. I can imagine, were there people who were convinced it was real? And
yeah. Yeah. It was great.
That's amazing.
But Shock, always a very, very dear place in my heart. Great, great guy.
Yeah. And, you know, another West Coast guy we've had as a guest on the show, actually, is Paris.
Yes.
And so first of all, what made him kind of stand out to you? Because he was doing something that, I mean, I guess had kind of predecessors in Public Enemy, but there weren't that many other people really doing the kind of very, very political stuff he was doing.
Yeah, well, Rod Houston, mm-hmm. who was overseeing all of our video and who is now one of the biggest voiceover artists in the entire country.
This Thanksgiving, be one of the first people to see Creed.
I've been fighting my whole life. It's not a choice for me.
Critics and audiences are raving. It's pound for pound the best movie of the year. Four
stars. Rod Houston was Tommy Boy's director of music video production from 1986 until 1998. He has in recent years done voiceover work and narration for scores of movies, movie trailers, commercials, TV shows, and video games.
Was out in the Bay Area overseeing a digital underground video, and that's where he met Paris and brought back, you know, a demo tape of Paris. And we liked it a lot. There was, you know, a lot of people said that it sounded a lot like Rakim. His initial recordings.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Two black brothers took a walk in the South Side. Could have been any brother looking for a dope ride. Seeing a white girl wasn't in the plan, but the plan had plans of its own for a brother man.
Joke. I used to let the mic smoke. Now I slam it when I'm gonna make sure it's broke. When I'm going, no one gets on.
But he obviously had his own thing going on, and it, so it was great. The tracks were great. He was great. It was different. It was coming from a different place for us as a label. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we signed Paris and had success with Paris. We also had some conflicts with Paris.
Of course.
Which everybody knows about now.
Right. So obviously we've heard the version of his side of kind of what went down.
I actually got dropped from Tommy Boy. Probably because there was somebody there whose husband was a cop. Because what she did, it was somebody that worked on the staff that showed the artwork for a single called Coffee, Donuts, and Death to her husband or something. I forgot. I don't, you know, so long ago. I don't really remember what the specifics were. But she was mortified by it and very much offended by that because, you know, Coffee, Donuts, and Death was a song about the revenge, you know, and again, this is in 92, 91. The revenge killing of a racist cop who brutalizes people in the community.
Stepped up, crept up as I held my breath and then I squeezed.
We need backup. We got officers down. We need backup. We got officers down. Here we go.
Which at the time was something that was unheard of in music. You know, it's kind of commonplace now for a lot of acts. But at the time, especially in you know, on the heels of Cop Killer, it wasn't something that occurred all that often, you know, and there were just probably three or four acts doing it, me included. And so that combined with Bush Killer in the wake of the Cop Killer controversy is what got our is what caught the attention of Jerry Levine and Mo Austin at Warner Music. So we all went to Warner Music. It was me. It was Ice-T. It was Kool G Rap. It was a representative from Tommy Boy and from, I think it was Cold Chillin' at the time, and a couple of other labels. And we all got let go in this big round table meeting that occurred.
For you, like what happened?
Yeah.
What
horrible.
Happened with Bush Killer? What happened with him?
It
you
was
know,
it was horrible.
Not being
what
on the label
happened?
Anymore.
It was horrible. What happened? It was you know, I'm not going to sit here and say I remember everything. I'm sure Paris remembers more about it than I do. But I will tell you what I do recall that really was very disturbing was that there was a woman working for me at the time, a young woman who took it upon herself to basically take this artwork for Paris's album cover and share it with her husband, her cousins, her uncles, everyone who was, they were all cops.
The original original cover of Paris's 1992 album Sleeping with the Enemy showed the rapper dressed like an assassin in all black and holding a gun, hiding behind a tree as then-President George H.W. Bush walks by. The cover is a nod to Paris's controversial song Bushkilla, which appeared on that album. The album also contained the police revenge fantasy Coffee, Donuts, and Death. Tommy Boy ended up not releasing the record, and it came out on Paris's own Scarface Records. We'll have a link to the cover art in the show notes for this episode.
And she got the New York State Sheriff's Association. It might be a little different name. Basically, she got us in an enormous amount of trouble with this artwork that hadn't even gone into production. We were sort of grappling with this ourselves about how do we approach this? Are we going to use this? Mm-hmm. It was a delicate situation.
Sure.
And we were part of Warner's at the time, too. There was a lot of considerations that had to go into this. And I know everyone can say, oh, y'all were pussies for not putting it out. You know, it's not always quite that simple. But the point was, we hadn't even made a decision yet on what, you know, on the artwork before it basically got, you know, taken by this woman and, you know, made impossible for us to use it. And it created, like, you know, World War III. So that happened. And it was sort of hot on the heels, too, of, you know, Ice-T and all this stuff that was going on.
Right, the cop killer stuff was controversy. It was right around that time.
Yeah, well, that was also Warner Brothers. And remember, he was on Sire Records.
Oh, right.
Yes. And, you know, I remember going to the Time Warner shareholders meeting I think it was the Four Seasons in Los Angeles.
Was that the one where Charlton Heston read
yes.
the lyrics? Yeah.
It was, boy, that was...
You were there.
Yes.
Wow.
It was astounding.
I got my brain on hype. Tonight'll be your night. Die, 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 pig, die. The police. I know your family's grieving. Come. Catchy little number, isn't it?
On July 16th, 1982, actor and conservative activist Charlton Heston stunned the attendees of a Time Warner shareholders meeting by reading the lyrics to the Body Count songs KKK Bitch and Cop Killer. Heston said at the time that he wasn't criticizing Ice-T, but rather the Time Warner higher-ups. For a first-hand account of the frenzy around Body Count song Cop Killer, check out episode 131 with Ice-T's then-girlfriend, Darlene Ortiz.
Now, we were there, and there was, you know, when the police mobilized for things like that, they mobilized because they had people there in wheelchairs and, you know, heavy cop prints, you know, this is what Ice-T and Paris are going to lead to this Michigas and... You know, so it was tense. But when Charlton Heston stood up in the back of the room and started, you know, reciting the lyrics to what I think it was KKK Bitch is the one that he was reciting. I don't know. You know, to this day, I don't know if anyone recorded it because that would have been, you know, YouTube gold right there.
Right. Incredible. I can't believe you were there. That's wild. So, you know, we have to touch a little bit on De La Soul. You mentioned them a couple of times.
Of course.
Obviously, hugely important group to, you know, to the label and to hip hop in general. And you got their demo a couple of years before the first record came out.
No. It wasn't a couple of years. No. It was, things actually moved pretty quickly with that. The De La Soul, I first heard about De La Soul from Daddy-O of Stetsasonic. And Daddy-O was shopping. He called me and said, you know, yeah, and Paul's working with this group. They're really ill. They're called De La Soul. And I'm like, you know. The name is stuck in my head, but he was also shopping a couple of other acts, and he came to the office one night, and he had I still have this cassette too. It's a cassette with three groups on it, and De La Soul was sort of wedged in between these two other acts that were more R&B type of acts that didn't go anywhere, but kept the original notes, sort of summarizing, you know, each of the acts.
Right.
But yeah, I have this summary of notes that I wrote about it and saying that I really thought De La Soul was the one, and that, like, plus they got a cool name. But there were two songs on the demo. Plug Tune In was one of them.
Answering any offer service, prerogative, praise positively, I'm acquitted. Enemies publicly shame my utility. After the battle, damn bitches, I'm with it.
And I think the other one was might have been Freedom of Speak.
Right, every day I wake up. Look at my travels, they're scuffed up. Ring over the telly, which I pick up. Turn on the news as it screws up. Mace on the line of
played it for other people. Mm-hmm. At Tommy Boy, and everyone was, you know, it was immediately that type of thing where it had that dusted sound to it. I shouldn't even say that dusted sound, because it really had a sound that no one had done. It was completely different, and it was going to be a group that either completely captured people's imaginations or they weren't going to do anything. There wasn't a middle ground. They right. weren't already going down an established lane. They created a whole new lane.
Mm.
And to the credit of, you know, the New York audience and DJs, they grasped the De La Soul thing pretty quickly. I mean, you know, the De La Soul, there was a mystery about them. What the fuck are they talking about? What right. is this?
Right. Even you now, know? I think people are still trying to suss that out, you know?
Yeah. And then the whole thing with the skits and all this stuff was new at the time, you know? And I remember meeting with the guys for the first time when they came to the office, and they were sitting across from me, and I had this office, so kind of a small office, when we were up on First Avenue, and right across the office, my office was the only bathroom in the entire place. So it was always kind of crowded and congested over there. But I just remember these guys sitting across from me, very straight-faced, quiet, you know, they weren't trying to sell me or anything. And they were introducing themselves as Pasta News, Trugoy the Dove, and Maceo. Maceo was like the most normal, you right. know, that one I could grasp. But, you know, Pasta News, yeah, it sounds sop backwards. And, you know, Trugoy, yogurt, the Dove, you know, it was like this whole thing. So
how do you market something that no one's heard before?
Well, some of it is what we would do, I guess, with any act, let the people decide. But no, with them, I think there was a really great effort by the label and everyone involved to introduce them in a way that was as special as they were.
Mm-hmm.
And that included, obviously, the packaging. It included their first live show, which is where they were with their dancers, Asia, and I can't remember the other girl's name, where they were doing the holding up the cards like the Bob Dylan song.
The Asia Monica mentions here is actress and graphic artist Asia Minor. She described her time with the group in a recent article in Ebony. Asia said, quote, "The label had been worried that their live show was kind of boring, but when they hired me and another dancer, they had us on stage doing skits, riding tricycles, and roller skating. I was 16 years old, but these guys were taking me around the world. We were like a tight-knit family that looked out for each other. They were like my three big uncles."
And they looked different. They dressed different. The videos were different.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was really considered. And it worked. We did. We also had these great De La Soul pendants that were a really cool, like, leather pendant with their logo on it. And those became very popular and are sort of like hen's teeth. I only have, like, maybe four or five of them in storage. I sent one to Paz last year. He was really happy to get one. I sent one to Dante recently because he didn't have one. And I said, yeah, you need to have one of these. So in any case, it was... I mean, so much could be said about De La Soul. Right. There's been a couple of documentaries that have come out recently, and of course their new album has been very well received.
Yeah.
I love those guys, and it's really, really just overall, I think, a very gratifying thing to be able to point to these artists and say, wow, we're in 2016, and look what they're doing. you know? So. Yeah.
And, you know, so Naughty by Nature.
Yeah, Naughty by Nature.
My fellow Jerseyites.
I forgot to mention Naughty by Nature.
Yeah.
The cavalcade of hits.
Is the story about Tretch releasing a bunch of rats and snakes in your office, is that true?
Yes, it is true. But let me just be clear about this. They weren't rats and snakes. They were mice and more like garter snakes. They were like the type of things you get at a pet store to feed rats and snakes. Yes, and I keep thinking it's so funny that that happened. Can you imagine that happening today with, you know, Twitter and texting and everything? It would have, the amount of time that that information took to travel from Yorkville down to the source office and, you know, to the greater world, it really didn't take long. I'm sure people were on the phone immediately because it was like, oh my God, this is the biggest news to hit hip hop. The reason that that happened was because, there was this legal tussle that was going on that had to do with the cassette packaging for the Naughty by Nature album, and they wanted to have an extra panel in the packaging to advertise Naughty gear.
Right.
And it wasn't even something that I was directly involved with so much as there was a conversation back and forth between our business affairs person and their attorney about, well, who's going to pay for this extra panel? I mean, it all sounds so ridiculous now. I think their attorney at the time might have gotten them sort of fired up, like, well, Tommy Boy's given us some, you know, pushback on this or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And Tretch and a couple of his buddies got, I think he might have been smoking the pot, Sean. I think he was. But they showed up at the office, like, it was like late morning or something. I was like, well, you know, what the hell are you doing up? And, you know, and the way it was told to me is that they initially wanted to go to Tom's office. Mm. You know, they sort of barged into the offices. They wanted to go. Tom wasn't there. Go right around the corner to my office. And there was this shoebox where they had the little, you know, the mice and the little garter snakes in there. And they just, you know, released them onto the floor. And, of course, I'm sure I probably went, you know, and then they left, you know, and within an hour, I get a call from their manager, Shakim, who had found out, or I don't know what he knew at that point, but he apologized. He said, you know, he shouldn't have done that, da, 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 da. It doesn't matter. By that time, the damage was done,
right,
and it became one of those larger-than-life stories.
Right.
And, you know, by time, we're trying, yeah, and they released dragons and cobras.
Right.
Yeah. Everyone loves a good,
and yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone loves a good label diss story, you know, where someone, you know, getting the shit beat out of them, like, oh yeah, and they took a bat to him or, you know, whatever.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah, but that's what happened. And Tretch and I have had and KG and Vinny, we've all had many, many pleasant, you know, contacts since then. But yeah, that was a funny one.
Yeah. Well, that does relate to something, you know, very real in your career, which is sometimes overlooked, which is the clothing line. So Naughty by Nature had their clothing line, but you guys also had Tommy Boy or Tommy Gear, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that there was that grew out of, I think, the success we had doing these promotional items and tchotchkes for our group. I mean, for De La Soul, we had the great De La Soul pendants. For Digital Underground, we had the sex packets. For Queen Latifah, we had these beautiful Queen Latifah bar pins. Even going back to Bambaataa and Soul Sonic Force, Afrika Bambaataa, Tom and I bought a jillion Zulu beads down in New Orleans, and those became really a hot commodity. For Naughty by Nature, you know, just those
the OPP stickers is, you know, just a sticker. Stickers were like a big thing back then. Mm-hmm. But we'd done a lot of fun promotional items. We did a little bottle of cold sweat when Fresh Gordon did Feelin' James in the mid-'80s. I mean, I saved all this stuff, mm-hmm. you know, and I have samples of them. But yeah, the Tommy Boy gear, actually, I would say the first thing that we started making very regularly that became enormously popular were lanyards. Now, lanyards were, you know, the lanyard.
Of course, yeah, I remember them.
Yeah, and to a large degree, that sort of came out of the lanyards that people would wear to the New Music Seminar, which was a big hip-hop magnet. Mm-hmm. You know, they had the big battle, mm-hmm. the DJ and MC battle at the New Music Seminar. But everyone would wear their New Music Seminar badge with this lanyard. And the thing was, everyone wanted to look official. There was a big thing about being official, being looking like you're part of the industry. I know it sounds a little silly in 2016, but you know, back then it was like, oh yeah, you're on the subway and you're wearing your lanyard. So we said, well, gosh, maybe we should start making these promotionally, and we did. We changed the. It was like maybe about an inch wide, and it said Tommy Boy on it. And every few months, we would make new ones with different colors, different fabrications. And we even did a deluxe lanyard that was a special edition that only went to, select list of people that was made out of leather, you know, with like whip stitching on it and embroidered. It was, you know, this heavy sort of like plate at the bottom said Tommy Boy. But yes, Albie Ragusa, who was another incredibly great A&R guy that worked at Tommy Boy, had a fantastic eye for fashion. He always knew what was going on. He was plugged in with the guys at Stussy and Union and all, you know, he really was that guy who really had, the musical ear and talent and worked well with the artists, but he also really understood fashion scene that was coming up as part of the hip hop.
Well, you were no slouch at that yourself. I mean, you were famous at the time for like photographing people on the street and trying to find out what was going on that way.
I love doing that. I still do that actually. Really? But it was Albie who, I kind of put Albie in charge of like developing Tommy Boy gear, and he did a fantastic job. So yeah, it was an early. I would say it represents an early push in terms of the hip hop community moving into fashion and apparel. Now, one thing that happened was we did these really great sort of black nylon vests, you know, those insulated vests. They still sell them. They're like industrial vests or something. And we decided to make a promotional vest. And across the back of the vest, there was this large embroidered logo that said Tommy Boy. But we because Tommy Hilfiger was coming up at the time, we made a little play. We used the word Tommy Boy, but we used the Tommy Hilfiger colors and logo. It was sort of it was a lighthearted, actually, if anything, it was a nod mm-hmm. to Hilfiger. But boy, they came down on us in this very ugly, heavy-handed way and sent us a cease and desist and da-da-da-da-da. But not before we'd already laced a lot of key people, like, you know, the guys on the Knicks and all these other people around town. So a lot of people were wearing that vest. And, of course, the big item, the big ticket item that is iconic is the Carhartt jacket.
The jackets, right.
Yeah. Which was photographed for the New York Times and all these other places. It became like, wow. And it was great. It was sort of this item that really, I think, was an official indication of how workwear and brands like Carhartt and hip hop had this unexpected intersection. This is all taken for granted now, but you know.
Right now, you're like, oh yeah, Timberlands and everything. Carhartts and yeah, right. That's it's the all, New York uniform or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. There hasn't been a single legacy brand of clothing that hasn't been used by some hip hop or other design entity and rebranded.
Yeah.
But at the time, the Carhartt jacket with the big yellow Tommy Boy across the back was really like, oh shit. Yeah. So sometimes I meet people say, I still got my Carhartt jacket. So I'll awesome. Save it.
So one thing I have to ask, I didn't realize this until I kind of went back and researched for this, but there was quite the little sort of controversy in the early 90s about jumping. Who invented jumping? Was it Criss Cross or House of Pain or Naughty by Nature? There were newspaper articles written about this. You're quoted in one of them.
Oh, I am?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I don't even remember that controversy. Who invented jumping?
I just that both jump and jump around were out at around the same time.
Oh.
And it was like, did one copy off the other?
Criss Cross's Jump was released on February 6, 1992, while House of Pain's Jump Around was released on May 5th of that year. But another Tommy Boy act, Naughty by Nature, used to lead the crowds in their live shows in jumping at around the same time, something Monica pointed out in a 1992 Philadelphia Inquirer article about the controversy. Tretch would respond to the controversy in a lighthearted way on the Naughty by Nature song, Craziest.
If you ain't jumping, then no puppet. I'm hitting Jermaine in Atlanta because he owe me loot for that jump shit. Fuck astronauts.
Oh, jeez, I don't know. Honestly, I don't recall that being a controversy, but I guess there was room for both because they both had big hits.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, if jumping is some sort of a dance or, you know, movement or whatever, I mean, that's you know, from time eternal, you know, you could go back through the past 100 years of popular music and see that if there's a big dance or a big move that many people celebrated in song. So, right. You know, yeah.
When did you stop working at Tommy Boy?
February 98.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
What was behind that?
I was really burnt out on just in general. I had been working really hard and, the industry was really changing, and in my mind, it wasn't fun anymore. We were sort of in that era where the major labels were pulling Brinks trucks up to the, you know, back door of, you know, hot producers and smaller labels and artists, and were basically the major labels were really starting to take over the hip hop industry as it was. And I didn't feel like the fun was there. And I also, you know, just was like, okay, I've done this for a long time. I don't know if this is what I really want to keep doing. There were changes going on at the label too. It'd become a large company.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that I really did best in a leaner, meaner, smaller environment. And so for both personal and professional reasons, I was like, you know what? It's time to get out while the getting out is good.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad I did because, you know, it was within 2 years or so, the entire music industry was in turmoil. And facing some really big challenges with the whole digital revolution. But yeah, you know, how long was I there? 17 years or so.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think I put in some, they got the best of me. I gave it my all. Honestly, it was huge, huge fun, incredibly rewarding. And, you know, I think that, you know, I'm very, very proud of not only the time I did at Tommy Boy, but so many of the people
that I've worked with at the label.
Right. We didn't even really touch on that. Some of whom have been guests on the show, Dante Ross and Paul Stewart, people like that.
Yep.
Who you sort of oversaw as when they were A&R people.
Yeah. You know, we had a reunion recently of Tommy Boy staff, and I many of whom I keep in touch with. But what's so great is to see so many of them doing well. Mm. And they've gone on to big careers, and not necessarily in the music business. I mean, Rod's a great example.
Right.
But many of them, you know, Chris Atlas is like still, you know, big deal in the music business. And
Chris Atlas started as an intern at Tommy Boy and is currently the senior vice president of marketing at the Island Def Jam Music Group.
But there's a lot of people that, you know, whether it's just that they're happy, healthy, and have families, or they've gone off to entirely different careers, it's always, you know, a lot of these people will come up to me and say, you know, I remember when I got called to your office, I was always afraid because you always had that list. I had this, would keep this obsessive list of like what everyone was supposed to be doing. So they said, you were so tough on me, but I'm glad you were. So that's actually, I would say, something that really gives me a lot of joy.
Wow.
And in the winter of my years.
And what are you doing right now?
I'm writing. Yeah.
Memoir?
Could be, yeah.
Okay.
I don't want to talk about it too much because, you know, I just want to do it. Mm-hmm. But yes, I also have worked on music projects over the year. A&R'd an album for a country artist that went number one in the country charts. Yeah. Oh,
what was that?
Martina McBride.
Oh, okay.
A few years ago.
Monica A&R'd McBride's 2014 album of covers of soul and R&B songs, Everlasting.
And also, one of the things I've done, besides projects with Latifah and Shakim, I've also had a long-standing run as a host of my own radio show on WFMU.
Hey, everybody, it's Monica here with you this chilly Sunday evening on WFMU.
So that, yeah, I used to joke that when I left the music industry is when I started learning about music. I left Tommy Boy and I started working part-time at a record store called Footlights, which specialized in soundtracks and vocalists and show tunes. And I was always like a huge record collector, even when I was a kid. When I was that kid that was always buying 45s every week, you know, off the radio. But, you know, I had amassed like over 10,000 vinyl albums, which now are being sold. I have a vinyl annuity. A couple friends of mine are selling off my collection. but yeah. I've taken care of some family stuff also that needed time and attention. So yeah, have done various things since leaving Tommy Boy.
Awesome. Well, Monica Lynch, thank you so much. And
thank you, Sean.
The world thanks you for all the great music and for Jock Jams.
Well, you know you make me wanna Jock Rock and Jock Jams were compilations put out by Tommy Boy, some in partnership with ESPN, of the type of music you would expect to hear at sports arenas. Monica, who was a regular at Knicks games in the early 90s, told the Huffington Post how she got the idea. She said, quote, I would hear the same music being played at the games, all these classic rock and R&B tracks with these organ bits in between, so I thought this stuff would probably be pretty easy to license.
Oh my God! Jock Jams! Jock Rock! Jock Jams!
Your idea?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Well, it was, you know, we actually as a label had enormous success with compilations even before Jock Jams, because we had the whole MTV Party to Go series.
MTV Party to Go was a 10-volume series of dance music compilation albums released on Tommy Boy between 1991 and 2001.
And we also had our own greatest hits compilations and perfect beats.
Perfect Beats series was Tommy Boy's 1998 4-volume compilation of early electro, rap, and freestyle hits.
And, you know, soundtracks and some other things. So, but yeah, You know, Jock Jams has finally gotten the respect that it always deserved. Like, there's been a Jock Jams resurgence in recent years. So that's good. I'm happy you brought that up. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you. Of course, it absolutely blew my mind to hear RZA's demo tapes. And if you want to hear more from them, make sure to sign up as a Patreon supporter by the end of October. But just as much as hearing that stuff, I loved hearing about what it took to discover, nurture, and market all the incredible talent that Tommy Boy shared with the world in its heyday. Also, it was fascinating to hear what the Bushkiller controversy looked like from the label's perspective after hearing Paris talk about it when he was on the show. Join us next week when our guest will be Joe Budden. Joe has a new album called Rage and the Machine, and we'll talk about that. But we'll also discuss his whole career and all the very public ups, downs, and feuds that have been a part of it. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program, and help us out with as little as a dollar a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, or complete archives, and more can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
I think he might have been smoking the pot.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
The result was Tender Love.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
I got a call from Spike Lee.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
We made sex packets.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Robbie Grizzly.
Yeah, I was like him.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Oh, wow. The chair of ill repute.